slightly larger than a two-man tent, it was big enough for two teenage boys to lie side by side with the river rushing past and the trees dappling their view of the sky framed by the triangular entrance. The first time they had been here, they had poked and dug at the back wall with sticks, but they had not found a secret passageway leading to the abbey above, so they gloried instead in the fact that they alone had discovered the hiding place and swore that it would be their secret in perpetuity. Andrew had a vague memory of a solemn oath, spit and swear words. They had called it the cave when they had first discovered it, but it was now, and had been for some time past, the cubby hole. The little recess smelt earthy, though the sloping ceiling was made of rock. The dark green tide mark showed that it had flooded in the past, not quite to the roof. The floor was covered in their cigarette butts and cardboard roaches. Andrew sat down, with his legs dangling over the sludge-green water, and pulled his cigarettes and lighter out of his jacket, bought with the last of his birthday money, now that his allowance had been stopped. He lit up, inhaled deeply, and relived the glorious encounter with Gaia Borden in as much detail as he could wring out of it. Narrow waist and curving hips, creamy skin between leather and t-shirt, full wide mouth. Oh, hi. It was the first time he had seen her out of school uniform. Where was she going, alone with her leather handbag? What was there in Pagford for her to do on a Saturday morning? Was she perhaps catching the bus into Yarville? What did she get up to when she was out of his sight? What feminine mysteries absorbed her? And he asked himself for the umpteenth time whether it was conceivable that flesh and bone wrought like that could contain a banal personality. It was only Gaia who had ever made him wonder this. The idea of body and soul as separate entities had never once occurred to him until he had clapped eyes on her. Even while trying to imagine what her breasts would look and feel like, judged by the visual evidence he had managed to gather through a slightly translucent school shirt and what he knew was a white bra, he could not believe that the allure she held for him was exclusively physical. She had a way of moving that moved him as much as music, which was what moved him most of all. Surely the spirit animating that peerless body must be unusual too. Why would nature make a vessel like that, if not to contain something still more valuable? Andrew knew what naked women looked like, because there were no parental controls on the computer in Fats's conversion bedroom. Together, they had explored as much online porn as they could access for free. Shaven vulvas, pink labia pulled wide to show darkly gaping slits, spread buttocks revealing the puckered buttons of anuses, thickly lipsticked mouths dripping semen. Andrew's excitement was underpinned, always, by the panicky awareness that you could only hear Mrs. Wall approaching the room when she reached the creaking halfway stair. Sometimes they found weirdness that made them roar with laughter, even when Andrew was unsure whether he was more excited or repulsed. Whips and saddles, harnesses, ropes, hoses, and once, at which even Fats had not managed to laugh, close-ups of metal-bolted contraptions and needles protruding from soft flesh, and women's faces frozen, screaming. Together, he and Fats had become connoisseurs of silicon-enhanced breasts, enormous, taut, and round. Plastic, one of them would point out, matter-of-factly, as they sat in front of the monitor with the door wedged shut against Fats's parents. The on-screen blonde's arms were raised as she sat astride some hairy man, her big brown-nippled breasts hanging off her narrow ribcage like bowling balls, thin, shiny purple lines under each of them showing where the silicon had been inserted. You could almost tell how they would feel, looking at them, firm as if there was a football underneath the skin. Andrew could imagine nothing more erotic than a natural breast, soft and spongy, and perhaps a little springy, and the nipples, he hoped, contrastingly hard. And all of these images blurred in his mind late at night, with the possibilities offered by real girls, human girls, and the little you manage to feel through clothes if you manage to move in close enough. Neve was the less pretty of the Fairbrother twins, but she had been the more willing in the stuffy drama hall during the Christmas disco. Half hidden by the musty stage curtain in a dark corner, they had pressed against each other, and Andrew had put his tongue into her mouth. His hands had inched as far as her bra strap and no further, because she kept pulling away. He had been driven chiefly by the knowledge that somewhere outside in the darkness, Fats was going further. And now his brain teemed and throbbed with Gaia. She was both the sexiest girl he had ever seen and the source of another entirely inexplicable yearning. Certain chord changes, certain beats, made the very core of him shiver, and so did something about Gaia Borden. He lit a new cigarette from the end of the first and threw the butt into the water below. Then he heard a familiar scuffling and leaned forward to see Fats, still wearing his funeral suit, spread-eagled on the hill wall, moving from handhold to handhold as he edged along the narrow lip of bank towards the opening where Andrew sat. Fats? Half? Andrew pulled in his legs to give Fats room to climb into the cubbyhole. Fucking hell, said Fats, when he'd clambered inside. He was spider-like in his awkwardness with his long limbs, his skinniness emphasized by the black suit. Andrew handed him a cigarette. Fats always lit up as though he were in a high wind, one hand cupped around the flame to shield it, scowling slightly. He inhaled, blew a smoke ring out of the cubbyhole, and loosened the dark grey tie around his neck. He appeared older and not, after all, so very foolish in the suit, which bore traces of earth on the knees and cuffs from the journey to the cave. You'd think they were bum chums, Fats said, after he'd taken another powerful drag on his cigarette. Cubby upset, was he? Upset? He's having fucking hysterics. He's giving himself hiccups. He's worse than the fucking widow. Andrew laughed. Fats blew another smoke ring and pulled at one of his over-large ears. I bowed out early. They haven't even buried him yet. They smoked in silence for a minute, both looking out at the sludgy river. As he smoked, Andrew contemplated the words, bowed out early, and the amount of autonomy Fats seemed to have compared to himself. Simon in his fury stood between Andrew and too much freedom. In Hilltop House, you sometimes cop for punishment simply because you were present. Andrew's imagination had once been caught by a strange little module in their philosophy and religion class in which primitive gods had been discussed in all their arbitrary wrath and violence and the attempts of early civilizations to placate them. He had thought then of the nature of justice as he had come to know it, of his father as a pagan god, and of his mother as the high priestess of the cult, who attempted to interpret and intercede, usually failing, yet still insisting, in the face of all the evidence, that there was an underlying magnanimity and reasonableness to her deity. Fats rested his head against the stone side of the cubbyhole and blew smoke rings at the ceiling. He was thinking about what he wanted to tell Andrew. He had been mentally rehearsing the way he would start, all through the funeral service, while his father gulped and sobbed into his handkerchief. Fats was so excited by the prospect of telling that he was having difficulty containing himself, but he was determined not to blurt it out. The telling of it was, to Fats, of almost equal importance to the doing of it. He did not want Andrew to think that he had hurried here to say it. You know how Fairbrother was on the parish council, said Andrew. Yeah, said Fats, glad that Andrew had initiated a space-filler conversation. Sipai's saying he's going to stand for his seat. Sipai is? Fats frowned at Andrew. What the fuck's got into him? He reckons Fairbrother was getting backhanders from some contractor. Andrew had heard Simon discussing it with Ruth in the kitchen that morning. It had explained everything. He wants a bit of the action. That wasn't Barry Fairbrother, said Fats, laughing as he flicked ash onto the cave floor. And that wasn't the parish council. That was what's-his-name Freely, up in Yarville. He was on the school board at Winterdown. Cubby had a fucking fit, local press calling him for a comment and all that. really got done for it. Doesn't Sci-Fi read the Yarvillain District Gazette? Andrew stared at Fats. Fucking typical. He ground out his cigarette on the earthy floor, embarrassed by his father's idiocy. Simon had got the wrong end of the stick yet again. He spurned the local community, sneered at their concerns, was proud of his isolation in his poxy little house on the hill. Then he got a bit of misinformation and decided to expose his family to humiliation on the basis of it. Crooked as fuck, Sci-Pi, isn't he? Said Fats. They called him Sci-Pi because that was Ruth's nickname for her husband. Fats had heard her use it once when he'd been over for his tea, and had never called Simon anything else since. Yeah, he is, said Andrew, wondering whether he would be able to dissuade his father from standing by telling him he had the wrong man and wrong counsel. Bit of a coincidence, said Fats, because Cubby's standing as well. Fats exhaled through his nostrils, staring at the crevice wall over Andrew's head. So will voters go for the cunt, he said, or the twat? Andrew laughed. There was little he enjoyed more than hearing his father called a cunt by Fats. Now, have a shifty at this, said Fats, jamming his cigarette between his lips and patting his hips, even though he knew that the envelope was inside the breast pocket. Here you go, he said, pulling it out and opening it to show Andrew the contents. Brown peppercorn-sized pods in a powdery mix of shriveled stalks and leaves. Sensimilla, that is. What is it? Tips and shoots of your basic unfertilized marijuana plant, said Fats, specially prepared for your smoking pleasure. What's the difference between that and the normal stuff? Asked Andrew, with whom Fats had split several lumps of waxy black cannabis resin in the cubbyhole. So it's a different smoke, isn't it? Said Fats, stubbing out his own cigarette. He took a packet of Rizzlers from his pocket, drew out three of the fragile papers, and gummed them together. Did you get it off Kirby? Asked Andrew, poking at and sniffing the contents of the envelope. Everyone knew Sky Kirby was the go-to man for drugs. He was a year above them in the lower sixth. His grandfather was an old hippie who'd been up in court several times for growing his own. Yeah, mine there's a bloke called Obbo, said Fats, slitting cigarettes and emptying the tobacco onto the papers. In the fields, we'll get you anything. Fucking smack if you want it. You don't want smack, though, said Andrew, watching Fats's face. Nah, said Fats, taking the envelope back and sprinkling the sensimilla onto the tobacco. He rolled the joint together, licking the end of the papers to seal it, poking the roach in more neatly, twisting the end into a point. Nice, he said happily. He had planned to tell Andrew his news after introducing the sensimilla as a kind of warm-up act. He held out his hand for Andrew's lighter, inserted the cardboarded end between his own lips, and lit up, taking a deep, contemplative drag, blowing out the smoke in a long blue jet, then repeating the process. "Hmm," he said, holding the smoke in his lungs and imitating Cubby, whom Tessa had given a wine course one Christmas.
Herbie, a strong aftertaste, overtones of...
Fuck. He experienced a massive head rush, even though he was sitting, and exhaled, laughing. Try that. Andrew leaned across and took the joint, giggling in anticipation, and at the beatific smile on Fats's face, which was quite at odds with his usual constipated scowl. Andrew inhaled, and felt the power of the drug radiate out from his lungs, unwinding and loosening him. Another drag, and he thought that it was like having your mind shaken out like a duvet, so that it resettled without creases, so that everything became smooth and simple and easy and good. Nice, he echoed Fats, smiling at the sound of his own voice. He passed the joint back into Fats's waiting fingers, and savoured this sense of well-being. So, you want to hear something interesting? Said Fats, grinning uncontrollably. Go on. I fucked her last night. Andrew nearly said, who? Before his befuddled brain remembered. Crystal Whedon, of course. Crystal Whedon. Who else? Where? He asked, stupidly. It was not what he wanted to know. Fats stretched out on his back in his funeral suit, feet towards the river. Wordlessly, Andrew stretched out beside him in the opposite direction. They had slept like this, top and tails, when they had stayed overnight at each other's houses as children. Andrew gazed up at the rocky ceiling, where the blue smoke hung, slowly furling, and waited to hear everything. "I told Cubby and Tess I was at yours, so you know," said Fats. He passed the joint into Andrew's reaching fingers, then linked his long hands on his chest and listened to himself telling. "Then I got the bus to the fields, met her outside Odbins."
"By Tesco's?" asked Andrew. He did not know why he kept asking dumb questions.
"Yeah," said Fats. "We went to the wreck. There's trees in the corner behind the public bogs. Nice and private. It was getting dark." Fats shifted position and Andrew handed back the joint.
"Getting in's harder than I thought it would be," said Fats. And Andrew was mesmerized, half inclined to laugh, afraid of missing every unvarnished detail Fats could give him. "She was wetter when I was fingering her." A giggle rose like trapped gas in Andrew's chest, but was stifled there. "Lot of pushing to get in properly. Is tighter than I thought."
Andrew saw a jet of smoke rise from the place where Fats's head must be.
"I came in about 10 seconds. It feels fucking great once you're in."
Andrew fought back laughter, in case there was more.
"I wore a Johnny. It'd be better without."
He pushed the joint back into Andrew's hand. Andrew pulled on it, thinking.
"Harder to get in than you thought. Over in 10 seconds. It didn't sound much, yet what wouldn't he give? He imagined Gaia Borden flat on her back for him, and, without meaning to, let out a small groan, which Fats did not seem to hear.
Lost in a fug of erotic images, pulling on the joint, Andrew lay with his erection on the patch of earth his body was warming, and listened to the soft rush of the water a few feet from his head.
"What matters, Arf?" asked Fats, after a long, dreamy pause.
His head swimming pleasantly, Andrew answered,
"Sex?"
"Yeah," said Fats, delighted.
"Fucking, that's what matters."
Propagating the species. Throw away the Johnnies. Multiply.
"Yeah," said Andrew, laughing.
"And death," said Fats. He'd been taken aback by the reality of that coffin, and how little material lay between all the watching vultures and an actual corpse. He was not sorry that he'd left before it disappeared into the ground.
"Gotta be, isn't it?"
"Death?"
"Yeah," said Andrew, thinking of war and car crashes, and dying in blazes of speed and glory.
"Yeah," said Fats. "Fucking and dying. That's it, isn't it? Fucking and dying. That's life. Trying to get a fuck and trying not to die."
"Or trying to die," said Fats. "Some people. Risking it."
"Yeah, risking it." There was more silence, and their hiding place was cool and hazy.
"And music," said Andrew quietly, watching the blue smoke hanging beneath the dark rock.
"Yeah," said Fats in the distance, "and music." The river rushed on past the cubby hole.
Part 2. Fair comment. 7:33. Fair comment on a matter of public interest is not actionable. Charles Arnold Baker, Local Council Administration, 7th edition. 1. It rained on Barry Fairbrother's grave. The ink blurred on the cards. Siobhan's chunky sunflower head defied the pelting drops, but Mary's lilies and freesias crumpled, then fell apart. The chrysanthemum ore darkened as it decayed.
Rain swelled the river, made streams in the gutters, and turned the steep roads into Pagford glossy and treacherous. The windows of the school bus were opaque with condensation. The hanging baskets in the square became bedraggled, and Samantha Mollison, windscreen wipers on full tilt, suffered a minor collision in the car on the way home from work in the city. A copy of the Yarville and District Gazette stuck out of Mrs. Catherine Whedon's door in Hope Street for 3 days until it became sodden and illegible. Finally, social worker Kay Borden tugged it out of the letterbox, peered in through the rusty flap, and spotted the old lady spread-eagled at the foot of the stairs. A policeman helped break down the front door, and Mrs. Whedon was taken away in an ambulance to Southwest General. Still the rain fell, forcing the sign painter who had been hired to rename the old shoe shop to postpone the job. It poured for days and into the nights, and the square was full of hunchbacks in waterproofs, and umbrellas collided on the narrow pavements. Howard Mollison found the gentle patter against the dark windows soothing. He sat in the study that had once been his daughter Patricia's bedroom and contemplated the email that he'd received from the local newspaper. They had decided to run Councillor Fairbrother's article, arguing that the fields ought to remain with Pagford, but in the interests of balance, they hoped that another councillor might make the case for reassignment in the following issue.
"Backfired on you, hasn't it, Fairbrother?" thought Howard happily. "There you were, thinking you'd have it all your own way."
He closed the email and turned instead to the small pile of papers beside him. These were the letters that had come trickling in, requesting an election to fill Barry's vacant seat. The Constitution stated that it required 9 applications to enforce a public vote, and he had received 10. He read them over, while his wife's and business partner's voices rose and fell in the kitchen, stripping bare between them the meaty scandal of old Mrs. Whedon's collapse and belated discovery.
"Don't walk out on your doctor for nothing, do you? Screaming at the top of her voice," Karen said.
"Saying she'd been given the wrong drugs, yes, I know," said Shirley, who considered that she had a monopoly on medical speculation, given that she was a hospital volunteer. "They'll run tests up at the General, I expect."
"I'd be feeling very worried if I were Dr. Joanda."
"She's probably hoping the Whedons are too ignorant to sue, but that won't matter if the General finds out it was the wrong medication."
"She'll be struck off," said Maureen, with relish.
"That's right," said Shirley, "and I'm afraid a lot of people will feel good riddance. Good riddance." Methodically, Howard sorted letters into piles. Miles's completed application forms he set aside on their own. The remaining communications were from fellow parish councillors. There were no surprises here. As soon as Parminda had emailed him to tell him that she knew of somebody who was interested in standing for Barry's seat, he had expected these 6 to rally round her, demanding an election. Together with Benzuria herself, there were the ones he dubbed the obstreperous faction, whose leader had recently fallen. Onto this pile he placed the completed forms of Colin Wall, their chosen candidate. Into a third pile, he placed 4 more letters, which were, likewise, from expected sources, professional complainers of Pagford, known to Howard as perennially dissatisfied and suspicious, all prolific correspondents to the Yarville and District Gazette. Each had their own obsessive interest in some esoteric local issue and considered themselves independent-minded. They were to be the ones most likely to scream nepotism if Miles had been co-opted, but they were among the most anti-Fields people in town. Howard took the last 2 letters in each hand, weighing them up. One of them was from a woman whom he had never met, who claimed, Howard took nothing for granted, to work at the Bell Chapel Addiction Clinic. The fact that she styled herself Ms. inclined him to believe her. After some hesitation, he placed this on top of Cubby Wall's application forms. The last letter, unsigned and typed on a word processor, demanded an election in intemperate terms. It had an air of haste and carelessness and was littered with typos. The letter extolled the virtues of Barry Fairbrother and named Miles specifically as unfit to fill his shoes, spelt S-H-E-O-S. Howard wondered whether Miles had a disgruntled client out there who might prove to be an embarrassment. It was good to be forewarned of such potential hazards. However, Howard doubted whether the letter, being anonymous, counted as a vote for an election. He therefore fed it into the little desktop shredder that Shirley had given him for Christmas. 2. Edward Collins and Co., the Pagford solicitors, occupied the upper floor of a terraced brick house with an optician's on the ground floor. Edward Collins was deceased, and his firm comprised two men. Gavin Hughes, who was the salaried partner, with one window in his office, and Miles Mollison, who was the equity partner, with two windows. They shared a secretary, who was 28, single, plain, but with a good figure. Shona laughed too long at all Miles's jokes, and treated Gavin with a patronage that was almost offensive. The Friday after Barry Fairbrother's funeral, Miles knocked on Gavin's door at 1 o'clock and entered without waiting for a summons. He found his partner looking up at the dark grey sky through the rain-speckled window.
"I'm going to nip up the road for lunch," said Miles. "If Lucy Bevan's early, will you tell her I'll be back at 2? Shona's out."
"Yeah, fine," said Gavin. "Everything all right?" "Mary's called. There's a bit of a glitch with Barry's life insurance. She wants me to help her sort it."
"Right. Well, you can handle that, can't you? I'll be back at 2 anyway."
Miles slipped on his overcoat, jogged down the steep stairs, and walked briskly up the rain-swept little street that led to the square. A momentary break in the clouds caused sunlight to flood the glistening war memorial and the hanging baskets. Miles experienced a rush of atavistic pride as he hurried across the square towards Mollison and Lowe, that Pagford institution, that classiest of emporia, a pride that familiarity had never blighted, but rather deepened and ripened. The bell tinkled at the door as Miles pushed it open. There was something of a lunchtime rush on. A queue of 8 waited at the counter, and Howard, in his mercantile regalia, fisherman's flies glinting in his deerstalker, was in full tongue.
"And a quarter of black olives, Rosemary, to you. Nothing else now? Nothing else for Rosemary? That'll be £8.62. We'll call it 8, my love, in light of our long and fruitful association."
Giggles and gratitude, the rattle and crash of the till.
"And here's my lawyer come to check up on me," boomed Howard, winking and chuckling over the heads of the queue at Miles. "If you'll wait for me in the back, sir, I'll try not to say anything incriminating to Mrs. Howson."
Miles smiled at the middle-aged ladies, who beamed back. Tall with thick, close-cropped greying hair, big round blue eyes, his paunch disguised by his dark overcoat, Miles was a reasonably attractive addition to the hand-baked biscuits and local cheeses. He navigated his way carefully between the little tables piled high with delicacies and paused at the big arch hewn between delicatessen and the old shoe shop, which was denuded of its protective plastic curtain for the first time. Maureen, Miles recognized the handwriting, had put up a sign on a sandwich board in the middle of the arch. "No entry. Coming soon. The copper kettle." Miles peered through into the clean, spare space that would soon be Pagford's newest and best cafe. It was plastered and painted, with newly varnished black boards underfoot. He sidled around the corner of the counter and edged past Maureen, who was operating the meat slicer, affording her the opportunity for a gruff and ribald laugh, then ducked through the door that led into the dingy little back room. Here was a formica table, on which Maureen's daily mail lay folded. Howard and Maureen's coats hanging on hooks, and a door leading to the lavatory, which exuded a scent of artificial lavender. Miles hung up his overcoat and drew up an old chair to the table. Howard appeared a minute or two later, bearing 2 heaped plates of delicatessen fare.
"Definitely decided on the copper kettle, then?" asked Miles.
"Well, Mo likes it," said Howard, setting down a plate in front of his son.
He lumbered out, returned with 2 bottles of ale,
and closed the door with his foot so that the room was enveloped in a windowless gloom, relieved only by the dim pendant light. Howard sat down with a deep grunt. He had been conspiratorial on the telephone mid-morning and kept Miles waiting a few moments longer while he flipped off the lid of one bottle. "Wall sent his forms in," he said at last, handing over the beer.
"Ah," said Miles.
"I'm going to set a deadline, 2 weeks from today, for everyone to declare."
"Fair enough," said Miles.
"Mum reckons this Price bloke is still interested. Have you asked Sam if she knows who he is yet?"
"No," said Miles. Howard scratched an underfold of the belly that rested close to his knees as he sat on the creaking chair.
"Everything all right with you and Sam?"
Miles admired, as always, his father's almost psychic intuition.
"Not great."
He would not have confessed it to his mother, because he tried not to fuel the constant cold war between Shirley and Samantha, in which he was both hostage and prize.
"She doesn't like the idea of me standing," Miles elaborated.
Howard raised his fair eyebrows, his jowls wobbling as he chewed.
"I don't bloody know what's got into her. She's on one of her anti-Pagford kicks."
Howard took his time swallowing. He dabbed at his mouth with a paper napkin and burped.
"She'll come round quickly enough once you're in," he said. "The social side of it, plenty for the wives, functions at Sweet Love House, she'll be in her element."
He took another swig of ale and scratched his belly again.
"I can't picture this Price," said Miles, returning to the essential point, "but I've got a feeling he had a kid in Lexi's class at St. Thomas's."
"Fieldsborne, though, that's the thing," said Howard. "Fieldsborne, which could work to our advantage. Split the pro-Fields vote between him and Wall."
"Yeah," said Miles. "Makes sense." This had not occurred to him. He marvelled at the way his father's mind worked.
"Mum's already rung his wife and got her to download the forms for him. I might get Mum to call him back tonight, tell her he's got 2 weeks, try and force his hand."
"Three candidates, then," said Miles. "With Colin Wall?"
"I haven't heard of anyone else. It's possible, once details hit the website, someone else will come forward, but I'm confident about our chances. I'm confident."
"Aubrey called," Howard added.
There was always a touch of additional portentousness in Howard's tone when he used Aubrey Fawley's Christian name.
"Right behind you. Goes without saying. He's back this evening. He's been in town."
Usually, when a Pagfordian said "in town," they meant "in Yarville." Howard and Shirley used the phrase, in imitation of Aubrey Fawley, to mean "in London."
"He mentioned something about us all getting together for a chat, maybe tomorrow. Might even invite us over to the house. Sam would like that."
Miles had just taken a large bite of soda bread and liver pate, but he conveyed his agreement with an emphatic nod. He liked the idea that Aubrey Fawley was right behind him. Samantha might jeer at his parents' thraldom to the Fawleys, but Miles noticed that on those rare occasions when Samantha came face to face with either Aubrey or Julia, her accent changed subtly and her demeanour became markedly more demure.
"Something else," said Howard, scratching his belly again. "Got an email from the Yarraville and District Gazette this morning, asking for my views on the Fields, as chair of the parish council."
"You're kidding. I thought Fairbrother had stitched that one up."
"Backfired, didn't it?" said Howard, with immense satisfaction. "They're going to run his article, and they want someone to argue against the following week. Give them the other side of the story. I'd appreciate a hand. Lawyer's turn of phrase and all that."
"No problem," said Miles. "We could talk about that bloody addiction clinic, that'd make the point."
"Yes, very good idea. Excellent."
In his enthusiasm, he had swallowed too much at once, and Miles had to bang him on the back until his coughing had subsided. At last, dabbing his watering eyes with a napkin, Howard said breathlessly,
"Aubrey's recommending the district cuts funding from their end, and I'm going to put it into our lot that it's time to terminate the lease on the building. It wouldn't hurt to make the case in the press. How much time and money's gone at that bloody place with nothing to show for it?
I've got the figures.
Howard burped sonorously.
Bloody disgraceful. Pardon me.
3. Gavin cooked for Kay at his house that evening, opening tins and crushing garlic with a sense of ill usage. After a row, you had to say certain things to secure a truce. Those were the rules. Everyone knew that. Gavin had telephoned Kay from his car on the way back from Barry's burial and told her that he wished she had been there, that the whole day had been horrible, and that he hoped he could see her that night. He considered these humble admissions no more or less than the price he had to pay for an evening of undemanding companionship. But Kay seemed to consider them more in the light of a down payment on a renegotiated contract. You missed me? You needed me when you were upset? You're sorry we didn't go as a couple? Well, let's not make that mistake again. There had been a certain complacency about the way she had treated him since, a briskness, a sense of renewed expectation. He was making spaghetti bolognese tonight. He had deliberately omitted to buy a pudding or to lay the table in advance. He was at pains to show her that he had not made much of an effort. Kay seemed oblivious, even determined to take this casual attitude as a compliment. She sat at his small kitchen table, talking to him over the pitter-patter of rain on the skylight, her eyes wandering over the fixtures and fittings. She had not often been here. I suppose Lisa chose this yellow, did she? She was doing it again, breaking taboos as though they had recently passed to a deeper level of intimacy. Gavin preferred not to talk about Lisa if he could avoid it. Surely she knew that by now. He shook oregano onto the mince in his frying pan and said, No, this was all the previous owner. I haven't got round to changing it yet. Oh, she said, sipping wine. Well, it's quite nice. Bit bland. This rankled with Gavin, as, in his opinion, the interior of the smithy was superior in every way to that of 10 Hope Street. He watched the pasta bubbling, keeping his back to her. Guess what, she said. I met Samantha Mollison this afternoon. Gavin wheeled around. How did Kay even know what Samantha Mollison looked like? Just outside the deli in the square. I was on my way in to get this, said Kay, clinking the wine bottle beside her with a flick of her nail. She asked me whether I was Gavin's girlfriend. Kay said it archly, but actually she had been heartened by Samantha's choice of words, relieved to think that this was how Gavin described her to his friends. And what did you say? I said yes. Her expression was crestfallen. Gavin had not meant to ask the question quite so aggressively. He would have given a lot to prevent Kay and Samantha ever meeting. Anyway, Kay proceeded with a slight edge to her voice, she's asked us for dinner next Friday, week today. Oh, bloody hell, said Gavin crossly. A lot of Kay's cheerfulness deserted her. What's the problem? Nothing, it's nothing, he said, prodding the bubbling spaghetti. It's just that I see enough of Miles during work hours, to be honest. It was what he had dreaded all along, that she would worm her way in and they would become Gavin and Kay with a shared social circle so that it would become progressively more difficult to excise her from his life. How had he let this happen? Why had he allowed her to move down here? Fury at himself mutated easily into anger with her. Why couldn't she realize how little he wanted her and take herself off without forcing him to do the dirty? He drained the spaghetti in the sink, swearing under his breath as he speckled himself with boiling water. You'd better call Miles and Samantha and tell them no, then, said Kay. Her voice had hardened. As was Gavin's deeply ingrained habit, he sought to deflect an imminent conflict and hoped that the future would look after itself. No, no, he said, dabbing at his wet shirt with a tea towel. We'll go, it's fine, we'll go. But in his undisguised lack of enthusiasm, he sought to put down a marker to which he could refer retrospectively. You knew I didn't want to go. No, I didn't enjoy it. No, I don't want it to happen again. They ate for several minutes in silence. Gavin was afraid that there would be another row and that Kay would force him to discuss underlying issues again. He cast around for something to say,
and so started telling her about Mary Fairbrother and the life insurance company. "They're being real bastards," he said. He was heavily insured, but their lawyers are looking for a way not to pay out. They're trying to make out he didn't make a full disclosure. In what way? Well, an uncle died of an aneurysm too. Mary swears Barry told the insurance agent that when he signed the policy, but it's nowhere in the notes. Presumably the bloke didn't realise it can be a genetic thing. I don't know that Barry did come to... Gavin's voice broke. Horrified and embarrassed, he bowed his flushing face over his plate. There was a hard chunk of grief in his throat, and he couldn't shift it. Kay's chair legs scraped on the floor. He hoped that she was off to the bathroom, but then felt her arms around his shoulders, drawing him to her. Without thinking, he put a single arm around her, too. It was so good to be held. If only their relationship could be distilled into simple, wordless gestures of comfort. Why had humans ever learnt to talk? He had dribbled snot onto the back of her top.
"Sorry,"
he said thickly, wiping it away with his napkin. He withdrew from her and blew his nose. She dragged her chair to sit beside him and put a hand on his arm. He liked her so much better when she was silent, and her face was soft and concerned as it was now.
"I still can't. He was a good bloke," he said thickly. "Barry, he was a good bloke."
"Yes, everyone says that about him," said Kay. She had never been allowed to meet this famous Barry Fairbrother, but she was intrigued by this show of emotion from Gavin and by the person who had caused it. "Was he funny?" she asked, because she could imagine Gavin enthralled to a comedian, to a rowdy ringleader, propping up the bar.
"Yes, I suppose. Well, not particularly. Normal. He liked to laugh, but he was just such a nice bloke. He liked people, you know."
She waited, but Gavin did not seem able to elucidate further on the niceness of Barry.
"And the kids, and Mary, poor Mary. God, you've got no idea."
Kay continued to pat his arm gently, but her sympathy had chilled a little. No idea, she thought, what it was to be alone. No idea how hard it was to be left in sole charge of a family. Where was his pity for her, Kay?
"They were really happy," said Gavin, in a cracked voice. "She's in pieces."
Wordlessly, Kay stroked his arm, reflecting that she had never been able to afford to go to pieces. "I'm all right," he said, wiping his nose on the back of his hand and picking up his fork. By the smallest of twitches, he indicated that she should remove her hand.
4. Samantha's dinner invitation to Kay had been motivated by a mixture of vengefulness and boredom. She saw it as retaliation against Miles, who was always busy with schemes in which he gave her no say, but with which he expected her to cooperate. She wanted to see how he liked it when she arranged things without consulting him. Then she would be stealing a march on Maureen and Shirley, those nosy old crones who were so fascinated by Gavin's private affairs but knew next to nothing about the relationship between him and his London girlfriend. Finally, it would afford her another opportunity to sharpen her claws on Gavin for being pusillanimous and indecisive about his love life. She might talk about weddings in front of Kay, or say how nice it was to see Gavin making a commitment at last. However, her plans for the discomfiture of others gave Samantha less pleasure than she had hoped. When on Saturday morning she told Miles what she had done, he reacted with suspicious enthusiasm.
"Great, yeah. We haven't had Gavin round for ages. And nice for you to get to know Kay."
"Why?"
"Well, you always got on with Lisa, didn't you?"
"Miles, I hated Lisa."
"Well, okay. Maybe you'll like Kay better."
She glared at him, wondering where all this good humour was coming from. Lexi and Libby, home for the weekend and cooped up in the house because of the rain, were watching a music DVD in the sitting room. A guitar-laden ballad blared through to the kitchen where their parents stood talking.
"Listen," said Miles, brandishing his mobile. "Aubrey
wants to have a talk with me about the council. I've just called Dad, and the Fawleys have invited us all to dinner tonight at Sweet Love.
No thanks, said Samantha, cutting him off. She was suddenly full of a fury she could not explain, even to herself. She walked out of the room.
They argued in low voices all over the house through the day, trying not to spoil their daughter's weekend. Samantha refused to change her mind or discuss her reasons. Miles, afraid of getting angry at her, was alternately conciliatory and cold.
How do you think it's going to look if you don't come? He said at 7:50 that evening, standing in the doorway of the sitting room, ready to leave, wearing a suit and tie.
It's nothing to do with me, Miles, Samantha said. You're the one running for office.
She liked watching him dither. She knew that he was terrified of being late, yet wondering whether he could still persuade her to go with him.
You know they'll be expecting both of us.
Really? Nobody sent me an invitation.
Oh, come off it, Sam. You know they meant they took it for granted.
More fool them, then. I've told you I don't fancy it. You better hurry. You don't want to keep Mummy and Daddy waiting.
He left. She listened to the car reversing out of the drive, then went into the kitchen, opened a bottle of wine, and brought it back into the sitting room with a glass. She kept picturing Howard, Shirley, and Miles all having dinner together at Sweet Love House. It would surely be the first orgasm Shirley had had in years. Her thoughts swerved irresistibly to what her accountant had said to her during the week. Profits were way down, whatever she had pretended to Howard. The accountant had actually suggested closing the shop and concentrating on the online side of the business. This would be an admission of failure that Samantha was not prepared to make. For one thing, Shirley would love it if the shop closed. She had been a bitch about it from the start.
I'm sorry, Sam. It's not really my taste. Just a teeny bit over the top.
But Samantha loved her little red and black shop in Yarville. Loved getting away from Pagford every day, chatting to customers, gossiping with Carly, her assistant. Her world would be tiny without the shop she'd nurtured for 14 years. It would contract, in short, to Pagford.
Pagford, bloody Pagford.
Samantha had never meant to live here. She and Miles had planned a year out before starting work, a round-the-world trip. They had their itinerary mapped out, their visas ready. Samantha had dreamed about walking barefoot and hand in hand on long white Australian beaches. And then she'd found out that she was pregnant. She had come down to visit him at Ambleside, a day after she'd taken the pregnancy test, 1 week after their graduation. They were supposed to be leaving for Singapore in 8 days' time. Samantha had not wanted to tell Miles in his parents' house. She was afraid that they would overhear. Shirley seemed to be behind every door Samantha opened in the bungalow. So she waited until they were sitting at a dark corner table in the Black Cannon. She remembered the rigid line of Miles's jaw when she told him. He seemed, in some indefinable way, to become older as the news hit him. He did not speak for several petrified seconds. Then he said, "Right, we'll get married." He told her that he had already bought her a ring, that he had been planning to propose somewhere good, somewhere like the top of Ayers Rock. Sure enough, when they got back to the bungalow, he unearthed the little box from where he had already hidden it in his rucksack. It was a small, solitaire diamond from a jeweller's in Yarville. He had bought it with some of the money his grandmother had left him. Samantha had sat on the edge of Miles's bed and cried and cried. They had married 3 months later. Alone with her bottle of wine, Samantha turned on the television. It brought up the DVD Lexi and Libby had been watching, a frozen image of four young men singing to her in tight T-shirts. They looked barely out of their teens. She pressed play. After the boys finished their song, the DVD cut to an interview. Samantha slugged back her wine, watching the band joking with each other, then becoming earnest as they discussed how much they loved their fans. She thought that she would have known them as Americans even if the sound had been off. Their teeth were perfect. It grew late. She paused the DVD, went upstairs and told the girls to leave the PlayStation and go to bed. Then she returned to the sitting room, where she was 3/4 of the way down the bottle of wine.
She had not turned on the lamps. She pressed play and kept drinking. When the DVD finished, she put it back to the beginning and watched the bit she'd missed. One of the boys appeared significantly more mature than the other three. He was broader across the shoulders, biceps bulged beneath the short sleeves of his T-shirt. He had a thick, strong neck and a square jaw. Samantha watched him undulating, staring into the camera with a detached, serious expression on his handsome face, which was all planes and angles and winged black eyebrows. She thought of sex with Miles. It had last happened 3 weeks previously. His performance was as predictable as a Masonic handshake. One of his favorite sayings was, "If it's not broke, don't fix it." Samantha emptied the last of the bottle into her glass and imagined making love to the boy on the screen. Her breasts looked better in a bra these days. They spilled everywhere when she lay down. It made her feel flabby and awful. She pictured herself forced back against a wall, one leg propped up, a dress pushed up to her waist, and that strong, dark boy with his jeans around his knees, thrusting in and out of her. With a lurch in the pit of her stomach that was almost like happiness, she heard the car turning back into the drive, and the beams of the headlights swung around the dark sitting room. She fumbled with the controls to turn over to the news, which took her much longer than it ought to have done. She shoved the empty wine bottle under the sofa and clutched her almost empty glass as a prop. The front door opened and closed. Miles entered the room behind her. "Why are you sitting here in the dark?" He turned on a lamp and she glanced up at him. He was as well-groomed as he'd been when he left, except for the raindrops on the shoulders of his jacket.
"How was dinner?"
"Fine," he said. "You were missed. Aubrey and Julia were sorry you couldn't make it."
"Oh, I'm sure. And I'll bet your mother cried with disappointment."
He sat down in an armchair at right angles to her, staring at her. She pushed her hair out of her eyes. "What's all this about, Sam?"
"If you don't know, Miles."
But she was not sure herself. Or at least, she did not know how to condense this sprawling sense of ill usage into a coherent accusation. "I can't see how me standing for the parish council..."
"Oh, for God's sake, Miles!"
she shouted, and was then slightly taken aback by how loud her voice was. "Explain to me, please," he said, "what possible difference it can make to you." She glared at him, struggling to articulate it for his pedantic, legal mind, which was like a fiddling pair of tweezers in the way that it seized on poor choices of word, yet so often failed to grasp the bigger picture. What could she say that he would understand? That she found Howard and Shirley's endless talk about the council boring as hell? That he was quite tedious enough already, with his endlessly retold anecdotes about the good old days back at the rugby club and his self-congratulatory stories about work, without adding pontifications about the fields?
"Well, I was under the impression," said Samantha, in their dimly lit sitting room, "that we had other plans."
"Like what?" said Miles. "What are you talking about?"
"We said," Samantha articulated carefully over the rim of her trembling glass, "that once the girls were out of school, we'd go travelling. We promised each other that, remember?"
The formless rage and misery that had consumed her since Miles announced his intention to stand for the council had not once led her to mourn the year's travelling she had missed, but at this moment it seemed to her that that was the real problem, or at least that it came closest to expressing both the antagonism and the yearning inside her. Miles seemed completely bewildered.
"What are you talking about?"
"When I got pregnant with Lexi," Samantha said loudly, "and we couldn't go travelling, and your bloody mother made us get married in double quick time, and your father got you a job with Edward Collins, you said we agreed that we'd do it when the girls were grown up. We said we'd go away and do all the things we missed out on." He shook his head slowly.
"This is news to me," he said. "Where the hell has this come from?"
Miles, we were in the Black Cannon. I told you I was pregnant, and you said, for Christ's sake, Miles, I told you I was pregnant, and you promised me, you promised...
You want a holiday, said Miles. Is that it? You want a holiday?
No, Miles, I don't want a bloody holiday. I want... Do you remember? We said we'd take a year out and do it later when the kids were grown up.
Fine, then.
He seemed unnerved, determined to brush her aside. Fine, when Libby's 18, in 4 years' time, we'll talk about it again. I don't see how me becoming a counsellor affects any of this.
Well, apart from the bloody boredom of listening to you and your parents whining about the fields for the rest of our natural lives.
Our natural lives, he smirked, as opposed to...
Piss off, she spat. Don't be such a bloody smart-ass, Miles. It might impress your mother.
Well, frankly, I don't see what the problem...
The problem, she shouted, is that this is about our future, Miles, our future, and I don't want to bloody talk about it in 4 years' time. I want to talk about it now.
I think you better eat something, said Miles. He got to his feet. You've had enough to drink.
Screw you, Miles.
Sorry, if you're going to be abusive. He turned and walked out of the room. She barely stopped herself throwing her wine glass after him. The council. If he got on it, he would never get off. He would never renounce his seat, the chance to be a proper Pagford big shot like Howard. He was committing himself anew to Pagford, retaking his vows to the town of his birth, to a future quite different from the one he'd promised his distraught new fiancée as she sat sobbing on his bed. When had they last talked about travelling the world? She was not sure. Years and years ago, perhaps, but... Tonight, Samantha decided that she, at least, had never changed her mind. Yes, she had always expected that someday they would pack up and leave, in search of heat and freedom, half the globe away from Pagford, Shirley, Mollison and Lowe, the rain, the pettiness and the sameness. Perhaps she'd not thought of the white sands of Australia and Singapore with longing for many years, but she would rather be there, even with her heavy thighs and her stretch marks, than here. Trapped in Pagford, forced to watch as Miles turned slowly into Howard. She slumped back down on the sofa, groped for the controls, and switched back to Libby's DVD. The band, now in black and white, was walking slowly along a long, empty beach, singing. The broad-shouldered boy's shirt was flapping open in the breeze. A fine trail of hair led from his navel down into his jeans.
5. Alison Jenkins, the journalist from the Yarvalin District Gazette, had at last established which of the many Whedon households in Yarvalin housed Crystal. It had been difficult. Nobody was registered to vote at the address, and no landline number was listed for the property. Alison visited Foley Road in person on Sunday, but Crystal was out, and Terry, suspicious and antagonistic, refused to say when she would be back or confirm that she lived there. Crystal arrived home a mere 20 minutes after the journalist had departed in her car, and she and her mother had another row.
Why didn't you tell her to wait? She was going to interview me about the fields and stuff. Interview you? Fuck off. What the fuck for?
The argument escalated, and Crystal walked out again, off to Nicky's, with Terry's mobile in her tracksuit bottoms. She frequently made off with this phone. Many rows were triggered by her mother demanding it back, and Crystal pretending that she didn't know where it was. Dimly, Crystal hoped that the journalist might know the number somehow and call her directly. She was in a crowded, jangling cafe in the shopping centre, telling Nicky and Leanne all about the journalist when the mobile rang.
Who? Are you the journalist, like? Who are you? Okay. It's Crystal. Who's this? I'm your aunt. Oh, it's Esther. Who? Shouted Crystal.
One finger in the ear, not pressed against the phone, she wove her way between the densely packed tables to reach a quieter place.
Danielle, said the woman, loud and clear on the other end of the telephone. I'm your mum's sister.
Oh, yeah, said Crystal, disappointed. Fucking snobby bitch, Terry always said when Danielle's name came up. Crystal was not sure that she'd ever met Danielle.
It's about your great-gran.
Who?
Nana Kath, said Danielle impatiently.
Crystal reached the balcony, overlooking the shopping centre forecourt. Reception was strong here. She stopped.
What's wrong with her? Said Crystal.
It felt as though her stomach was flipping over, the way it had done as a little girl, turning somersaults on a railing like the one in front of her. 30 feet below,